this week in the markets. Gold investors started the holiday season early, with the yellow metal soaring to the highest point in months. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzik. Just a pleasure to be with you here for this December 7th, Season 13, Episode 673, GoldSeek.com radio show. Well, the precious metals rose from the ashes, but it wasn't just gold and silver. Palladium, the new precious metal, flew higher, and just within a few dollars of parity with the yellow metal, a new weekly record close as investors just couldn't sell U.S. shares fast enough on disappointing U.S. jobs numbers and renewed trade dispute concerns between the two economic superpowers. Where is all of this financial market volatility coming from? Is it here to stay? What are the implications for our investment portfolios? Joining me with deep insights into the markets, Harry Estet Jr., the author of Zero Hour. Our guest has a very unique perspective on the cryptos. If we can find a bottom, he's looking for 25,000. However, I'm very concerned that we could see 3,000, 2,500, and perhaps lower. So I'd be very cautious there. But we're both believers in the blockchain concept, Internet 2.0. And in part two with Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors, the narrative includes cryptocurrencies, misconceptions surrounding one of our favorite markets. We discuss the $190 million Bitcoin transfer only required 10 cents. And then there's a $10,000 Bitcoin transaction recently, and these are both documented with articles that cost 1 cent to send these funds. Clearly, there's something of great uniqueness and value here. We also discuss a couple of interesting ICOs from last year, including Salt and Disclaimer. I own a few of these tokens, but pick them up on the discount. And we think that if the company and the market turns around, the 99% discount from its peak sure is appealing. And we'd like for you to call in to our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. You can call in and record your questions and comments, jot down this number and post it pad, or plug it right into your phone, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Well, mostly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals sector. Gold futures settled Friday at the highest level since July, the biggest weekly move in several months following disappointing U.S. jobs numbers. Investors poured funds into gold from U.S. shares. At Friday's close, gold was up 2%, $27, finishing at $12.52, its best weekly close in months. Silver picked up about 50 cents, closing at $14.70, while the shares, the XAU, added 5%, ending at $68. Black gold picked up $1.58, 3% higher at $52.60 per barrel. From a technical position, it still looks quite good following the two-month rout. And of course, OPEC had a meeting this week, which seemed to help put a floor underneath the commodity. Palladium, though, that stole the show, $12.58 as an intraday high. That, of course, is higher than the level that gold closed at $12.52. Just an amazing story as China continues to fill up its stockpiles. Bitcoin ETF, unfortunately, was off another dollar, another 20% losing week at $398. However, there was a big rally late Friday, so hopefully that will continue. Now that we've seen that 3,200 test, we could be headed back to retest 3,000. If that doesn't hold, I'm expecting 2,500. And then if that doesn't, you know, somewhere around 1,500 to 2,000 in the weeks ahead. So caution really advisable. On my Nuggets webpage, I have two really neat ways for investors to hedge themselves, even neophytes. U.S. dollar leaps, and there are options on Bitcoin where you can purchase puts if you're so inclined. This is not in any way an endorsement, but just a suggestion. In related news, the U.S. dollar flows into gold ETFs, such as the Spiders Gold Trust, ticker GLD, increased about $355 million in November. That's a record, a second consecutive monthly inflow, according to the World Gold Council, which noted that Brits continue to pour funds into the metal on lingering Brexit concerns. Gold ETFs are viewed as a proxy for the bullion market, offering just another venue in for investors. And three of my alpha stocks from the Alpha Stocks newsletter soared this week despite the massive selling, and I have to admit I posted late in the week. Still, several of the candidates soared within just a day or so of posting. Our portfolio was actually up for the week while the market was down, and of course, by delaying and missing all of that selling early in the week, helped stocks like Franco Nevada, I'll give one pro bono here away, ticker FNV, just soared, and two others in particular of the five or so in the report. So again, we continue to best the markets, and I'll put my candidates up against almost any weekly portfolio. So if you haven't signed up, we'd love to have you with us. Bottom line on precious metals and Bitcoin. Clearly, investors were displeased with the comments following the G20 meeting between the U.S. and China. That negative tariff talk and our solid domestic economic numbers helped push the greenback lower, and that benefited gold and the precious metals. Plus, we have Diwali and the Hindu festivals, as well as the North American and Western world holidays coming up, with Christmas, of course, and Hanukkah and many others. Perhaps that's helped put a floor under the markets. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, heavy cloud cover returned to the New York Stock Exchange this week after soaring an impressive 1,252 points, 5%. Last week, investors gave back virtually all of it, with the Dow down 1,150, 4.5%, ending at 24,400. Meanwhile, the S&P 500 shed the same percentage, off about 127, at 2633, and the NASDAQ gave back a brutal 361, 5.5%. The top story moving shares this week, a key domestic economic report from the Labor Department indicated a less than robust employment situation in the latest reading from key non-farm jobs, which disappointed at 155,000, well below the 200,000 expected. However, the unemployment rate did hold firm, a ray of sunshine there, at 3.7%. Investors sold the U.S. dollar in favor of gold on lowered expectations of rate hikes, but I wouldn't hold my breath there. The healthcare sector led the job gains, 40,000 new professionals in business services. Transportation and warehousing also had about 30,000, retailers as well, as folks prepare for holiday festivities. Of course, jobs are required. Manufacturers added 27,000 jobs despite the tariff issues, and mining and construction all benefited. U.S. shares, bottom line. The seemingly positive G20 meeting between the Chinese leader and the U.S. president in Buenos Aires last weekend reversed course abruptly with renewed tariff talks. That didn't seem to help, although I really believe this week was primarily about economic numbers. However, the USA Today Greed Fear Index, you know, still in the extremely fearful, about as overextended as possible. The herd is nervous here and volatility is very high. So I think caution is advisable, at least in the near term. Coming up after the break, more Gold Seek Radio. Another big GoldSeek.com radio episode, and our featured guest, he's the editor and chief investment strategist of Charts and Markets. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Hello there, and it's good to be with you, Chris.
We've had an interesting ongoing friendly discussion slash dialogue slash debate, if you will. I was early on it for that around 900 to 1,000. I said, this thing is going to go high. I don't know how high. You all called the top. And of course, it's very hard to shift gears when you've been bullish for a year. However, I did recently call the top at 6,000 to 8,400. And then the collapse came. You gave me credit for that. I appreciate that. So none of us, I guess, are 100%. We help people craft a better ontology, if you will, or worldview of what's going on in these financial arenas. Article today from a major outlet, of course, Reuters, brought to us by our friends at GATA, Chris Powell and Bill Murphy, that Bitcoin, its usefulness as a payment system is a distant dream as use for cryptocurrencies dries up, the use case. And I wanted to address this because it's a topic that I've debated with some of the really sharpest minds in the financial world today, and I think I've made a pretty solid case. And while talking with Tim Draper, hedge fund manager, if you will, and university creator in Silicon Valley, you may have heard he bought Bitcoin at $400 from U.S. Marshals, made about $1 billion off of that. We had a discussion on the show where we were discussing this topic. Visa and MasterCard process something like thousands of transactions per second, whereas Bitcoin, it's barely 10 or 20 per second. And they, you know, all these detractors are so quick to hop on the inconsistencies and ambiguities involved with cryptocurrencies, and in particular, the Bitcoin king, if you will, of the currency market. And I want to bring up a couple of interesting anecdotes that are 100% true that I think quickly and painlessly refute this case that's being used against Bitcoin. There was a transaction on the week that I spoke with Tim Draper last on the show, and it was something like in the neighborhood of $19 million was sent across borders to South America in Bitcoin. The person had to pay for a business transaction and opted not to do so in currencies. In order to settle the transaction, it would have required approximately 6 days, almost a week. There were $19,000 in fees associated with banking and many other legalities involved. Financial nightmare. Bitcoin transferred the bitcoins. There was a small fee, as I mentioned, it was $29 as opposed to $19,000. There's frankly no chargebacks allowed. Whereas with Bitcoin, once it's yours, it's yours. I mentioned to Bob Hoy, please tell your clients we're going to 3,500. The real risk here, if I can also look forward on Bitcoin, unfortunately, is once we find a consolidation pattern, start to look at 1,500 to even 1,000 for the next consolidation lows. Because it's a bubble, what do we know? 90% of the time, they return not just to the mean, but oftentimes overshoot their starting point.
Bubbles do the round trip up to extraordinary highs and back to where they started. But on the cryptocurrencies and blockchains and all of this stuff, I'm still staying, Chris, that somewhere out of this, there will be a constant valued currency that is liquid and tradable and accountable and all that. And I don't know about these guys at Sprott in Toronto. They're talking about a crypto gold-backed or something, which is great. Try everything, and out of it will come a currency that's usable, and it can't be abused by governments. Chris, our work on the popular uprising is where the public has had enough of experts in government, and the phrase I've used is they've had too much of in-your-face and in-your-wallet government. So it's another popular uprising where the people will take over their government. Now, also with this, they will make sure that they have a sound currency. No more using government nonsense currencies. So we are in very exciting times on that, and I'm convinced and that somewhere in here the blockchain crypto stuff will provide a as sound as currency as can be made. And that also is exciting. So then you'll say that, okay, if you got a constant valued currency, how can you make money in gold? Well, it's just like back when in England or the U.S. was on a gold standard. All you need to have the costs of mining drop relative to the price you're getting for the bullion. The miners make money. Like, for example, in 1929, the price of gold was fixed at that $20.67. With the costs going up in the boom, Homestake was the premier producer, and their costs went up, and they lost money, and the stock didn't perform well in the 1920s, and of course it came down in the crash, but you could buy it in 1931 for, let's say, $9 a share, and then with the contraction, mining costs, cost of power, cost of wages, cost of equipment went down. So that if you take a look then at Homestake at the end of 1932, when the price was still $20.67 a share, the stock was up something like 130%, and their earnings were up in that order as well. So it was backed. And then as you continued through the Depression, then Roosevelt devalued and you know, then took the price of gold to $35. But the main thing was is that the real price was going up. So that $9 homestake stock got up to something like $65. And it was then in those days, they gold miners paid everything out and by way of dividend. So during the 1930s, it was paying $4.50 a share on a $9 purchase. Now, that's not going to happen this time around because gold miners are interested in building assets rather than paying out cash. But you're going to have the same fabulous bull market for gold stocks. I hope I'm around for it.
Again, you sparked a couple of thoughts. Detractors are constantly pointing to the fact that Bitcoin is a haven for every other nefarious activity. At least two or three key inaccuracies in this belief that I'd like to address. Firstly, fiat money is the key means of procuring, you know, the underground, if you will, under the table. It is virtually every other activity we won't go into. So Bitcoin is the antithesis, I propose today, of useful for harmful activities simply because it's so easily tracked. It's a remarkably transparent transaction. Eventually, an alternative to an extremely ruthless and manipulated political currency mechanism that favors the elite and the globalists at the expense of the everyday individual, at the expense of personal freedoms and liberties.
Yeah, you're much more up on the details of all it is. And I'm just on to the major concept that the public will have a sound currency and the crypto side, the blockchain, will probably be involved one way or another. And it will be an idea here or there, but it will be an evolution. And, you know, I'm so excited about this popular uprising and the reform spreading around the world. And you look back at the last popular uprising, which was in the 1980s in Eastern Europe under the brutal fist of communism, where the public had had enough. They looked at how well the governing classes were living. They looked at the promises from the governing classes and look what they got. And there was an instant in time where, as you know, reading Solzhenitsyn about the Gulag Archipelago, where the police would come in the middle of the night and take you away. So, but that fist, the authoritarian fist, is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop. Now, the underside of this is the ordinary people who live under complacency for this, and it's like a turn in the financial markets where suddenly those on top lose the will to impose authority, and virtually at the same instant, and it changes. And whereas, like, you had a circumstance in Prague, Czechoslovakia in 1968, when there was an uprising, but then the communists had enough will to send in the tanks and the troops, and there was state murder there. And at the time of 1989, I was reading that Jaroslawski, the guy in East Germany, was thinking about sending in tanks to bring it down. But, Chris, they lost the will to do it. So here's what you have now going on in the United States and perhaps beginning in Canada, is the authoritarians are extremely ambitious, and they've got these crazy ideas about controlling the temperature of the planet, but they are, of course, doing it through taxes and regulations. And so the public can suddenly discover common sense. And this is what's going on now. The state that not only can it manage the economy, but it can also manage the temperature of the nearest planet. So you now are in what looks like a severe contraction, in which case the public's going to say, oh, you spent trillions of dollars of our tax dollars to prevent bad things from happening. No, bad things are happening. That sounds like a title for a Stephen King novel. And then the other one is you're spending trillions of dollars in hopes of controlling the temperature of the Earth. And the Thanksgiving weekend on the eastern part of the continent was extremely cold. One weather service says the nastiest start to winter on record. So then I believe that this cooling trend will continue. And then the public's going to say to their governments to think you can manage the temperature of the Earth. So these two events, the slowing economy and a cooling climate, will end the great experiment in authoritarian government that's gone on basically since 1900. And so here again, Chris, I tell my family and my colleagues that on the political side, we're in the most exciting times for the individual since the early 1600s, which was the last time the general public had to reform intrusive government. So, Chris, exciting times.
Exciting times indeed. And I'd like to close here with just a brief comment on this tragedy we've seen in Paradise, California. There were 12,000 structures lost, essentially every house, with very few exceptions, over 10,000 houses. That's single family homes, not hotels or apartments. 10,000 individual homes, over 100 lives, still hundreds missing, and hundreds if not thousands of displaced people who have no means to get back home. Payouts can take weeks, months, even years, and many people lost their bullion, their jewelry. So I've spent really a week crafting a proposal that I've sent to top folks, all the firefighter officials in California, Tim Draper and Elon Musk's teams, as well as now there's 8,000 evacuations in eastern Australia where there's raging infernos there as well, very common, of course, in Australia as well, very arid conditions. So as a result, I've sent to their 30 top firefighting officials in that region, and I'm calling it Poor Richard's $729 Neighborhood Fire Shield. And the basic gist of it, because we just don't have the time to go into all the details, for a very small amount of money, you can store in your basement or your garage a Mylar shield that rolls out and covers a house in only 20 minutes with two people. Can wrap it around the house and evacuate the premises. Now, unlike an earthquake or a tornado where there's very little time to prepare, most of these infernos are giant walls of fire that give hours and in many cases days of advance notice potentially in harm's way. Now, 20 minutes compared to hours, days, and or a week is ample time. And you might say, well, $720 sounds like a lot of money. 10,000 homes times $729, $7 million compared to the tens of billions that were just lost, hundreds of people, thousands of pets that were lost, entire towns missing. So again, $7 million is not even the budget of some of these medium-sized communities. Simply by storing them in a garage, the firefighters and other utility people would have quick access to it. They wouldn't even have to talk to the people. You could have it stored outside the house, just like a fire extinguisher, if you will, and they could be deployed very quickly by small teams in each neighborhood. And you might be thinking, well, Chris, that would take an enormous number of people. No, it would not, because these infernos, they come in walls of fire. So you would simply address one or two neighborhoods closest to the fire. It would only take a few hours per neighborhood, saving not only hundreds of lives per year, maybe thousands, but entire communities. Wouldn't it be a relief to know that others, tens of thousands perhaps, were spared such a tragedy? And not asking for donations or anything. Let's not let this tragedy become the next series of tragedies. Think of it as a last resort. The firefighters in the field, it's required that they carry a tent, a Mylar tent. They hop into it. If they get stuck, it just happens. Let's not let another town be lost.
We cover interest rates, equities, commodities, currencies, precious metals, and you can get in touch real easy, just bobhoy.com. And we welcome people to take a look at what we're doing. But just Google Bob Hoy and you'll get it. As you know, Chris, and you can get in touch with us, Bob Hoy, just do bobhoy.com, everybobhoy.com.
Bob Hoy, Institutional Advisor. We'll talk soon.
Good to talk. Bye-bye.
It's a pleasure to welcome back author of Zero Hour and editor of Economy and Markets. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
Your ominous view on equities paid off, at least in the last couple of months. This after 10 years of higher prices. Tell us more.
When I look at bubbles, the only way you can see that a bubble has finally burst, unfortunately, is when you see a really sharp crash. Like, and it typically is 30 to 50% in 2 to 3 months. I mean, the average is 42% the first 2.6 months. So once the bubble ends suddenly, and so every time we see what looks like a top, like January 2018, well, I look and say, okay, are we having a correction, which means 10 or 12%, maybe even 20%? Well, that's not the end of the bubble. I'm looking for 30, 40% at least in the first 3 months. We didn't see that in early 2018. So I said, you know what? That's not a top. Well, we had the same thing here. We see another top. We start to see some corrections and some scary days. But here we are. We're 2 months into this correction, and we've only been down about 12% at worst. And it's starting to rally. So I'm saying, you know, this is looking like a correction. Our best forecast, we've had scenario one and two for our subscribers in the last several months. And scenario one was a peak in late 2018 in the beginning of a bigger crash. And now in scenario two is, nope, we get a correction. And then we see one more leg up probably into around the third or fourth quarter of 2019. And then that would be a peak on our biggest cycle. It's a 90-year, I call it the bubble buster or great reset cycle, which would be similar to 1929 to 32 crash. So that's my forecast now, is that I think we've seen the worst of this correction. We may see a little more unless something goes really bad, really quick. This is not a top back in September. So, you know, we're going to see another leg up. It's possible that it could peak in early 2019, but my cycles would suggest at this point the most likely time for a top would be, like I said, somewhere between September and late next year, 2019. And then you see a crash on an almost exact 90-year lag to September 1929 into July 1932, and probably a similar magnitude, 80% or something. I'm still holding to that. This is the biggest bubble in history, and when it crashes, it's not going to be 40 or 50% like or in 2000 to 2002 or 2008 to 9 or the 70s. It's going to be 80% plus.
That was not at all what I was expecting to hear today because of the bearishness from our guests. I was expecting, you know, to say, yeah, that was it in September. We've seen the top. It's over. But it parallels my thoughts. There was so much pent up upward momentum on way too many cycles, no matter what cycle you look at, whatever fractal period you observe, that until that's wrung out of the system, it doesn't matter how much true fundamental bearishness there is. There are still the cycles to contend with, and it seems like your work parallels mine, that not until the Fed's probably finished with this rate cycle. You seem to think that might be it, period, for the markets. That also coincides with Martin Armstrong. He sees something similar in his models. That can't be good for the overall global economy or domestically. Tell us more.
Of course it's not good. And our two key dates in our cycles, you know, we had a major demographic cycle peak in late 2007. And, of course, we had the GFC, the Great Recession and all this stuff, and it was global and, you know, debt bubbles popping and some real estate bubbles popping, and nobody saw that coming. That was the baby boomers peaking in their spending, and just that slowing in momentum started to expose the debt problems. Well, then in 2009, central banks stepped in, led by the Fed, and just exploded money printing to offset what could have been a Great Depression. I think, you know, that was a time when our indicator said we could have had a much deeper. Now, we had the deepest recession since the Great Depression, but it wasn't a depression. It wasn't allowed to get that bad. We just got like 11% unemployment. I mean, a depression's more like 15, 20, 25%, and deflation in prices, which we only got a little bit of. So that kind of Great Reset is due, because we've been in the biggest bubble in real estate and stocks and commodities globally. And commodities is the only bubble that has burst. Stocks and real estate still have to burst and come down to reality. So our next big cycle date is 2019. That's more of a technology cycle. And it's a 45-year cycle. And every two cycles, you get a bigger bubble, because like electrical appliances were built on by PCs and internet, and you know, steamships were built on by railroads as a transportation revolution. So every 90 years we've seen the biggest bubble. We had the biggest bubble crashes in U.S. history were 1837 to 1842, and then 1929 to 32, and then on that 90-year cycle, that would hit in late 2019.
A 90-year cycle, I mean, that makes even Kondratiev's cycle seem tame by comparison. There's going to be, as far as the statistical dates of getting this timed correctly, there's a lot of plus or minuses on either side.
Yes, exactly. The cycle before the 19, all the bottoms have been 1842, 1932, and I've been projecting a bottom 2022 for demographic reasons and other cycle reasons. We have 20 and 40 year cycles that come in there, so it's not just, so 2022 has always been a key time for bottom for me, so I'm just, my best guess is yes, late 2019, that would give this leg another year up. You know, if this is just a correction, it'd be some, you know, we get another rally kind of like we got from early 2018 into late 2018. We get that sort of rally one more time. We get a Dow maybe 30,000 or a bit higher, and then we have this more pronounced crash. If we don't have it by 2022, I don't have any negative cycles for a while. So that would mean somehow that central banks have created a magic wand and we don't have to have bubbles reset and debts restructure anymore.
Let's talk about central banks, at least if we can believe their rhetoric. They'll be wrapping up their rate hiking cycle. Probably mid-summer next year, we're probably looking at three more rate hikes. You can believe the Fed Funds futures of the CBOE right now. We've got one more in December to go, and then another 75 basis points next year. But, you know, we're also hearing from the other key central banks that have been deeply in the negative on their overnight lending rates, you know, 3.75% of the PBOC, as well as the BOE and many others, especially the European Central Bank. So with them reversing course and now from a quantitative easing to quantitative tightening, that's the QT is their big mantra lately. How does that factor into your cycles? Because I know you look at more than just the technicals. You also observe the fundamentals.
Yeah, we do. And we've got a great chart that shows the global net bond purchases. And, you know, and they peaked, I think, in 2017, led by the U.S. The other countries are reluctantly cutting back their bond purchases, even intending to sell off. But the U.S. is into the selling stage, you know, $50 billion a month. That projects that we'll get back down, we'll kind of wash out this excess by early 2000. We'll get to zero money printing, basically, bond purchases by early 2020. So that's another indicator that says this should come to a head by the first course of 2020. That would be a time where a recession would be very, very likely to hit, and stocks tend to be ahead of a recession. So that's another thing that points to that to me. Another thing I look at is the last time real estate sales and prices. I was just in Australia on a five-city tour, and they brought me out there twice in 1 year, which is much more than usual because real estate's starting to crack there. Even though the economy's great and they got, you know, unbelievable growth and immigration, it's just prices are too high and they're cracking on their own bubble. And that tends to lead. Last time, the real estate sales peaked in late 2015. I think it's July 2015. Prices peaked in April 2006. Stocks didn't peak until October 2007, but much later. So it kind of, the whole thing was led by almost 2 years by real estate. And by the time, one of the leading indicators, and I'm tracking this now, the Dow Home Construction Index was already down 65% when stocks peaked in October 2017. That should have been a warning signal. They're down 35% recently. So if that keeps falling while stocks keep rising, that's going to be another sign that this bubble is getting ready to peak and burst. But it can go much lower. Last time it was down 65% before the stocks got it. So stocks can stay up in a bubble longer than real estate, because real estate's real. Real people largely have to buy and live in real estate. Real businesses have to buy, lease, or operate in real estate. But stocks and cryptocurrencies and tulip bulbs and stuff, they can get more overvalued in times like this. And what I see, Chris, is that all the signs are on the wall. We've had this short-term growth surge from tax repatriations and all this sort of stuff. That's not going to last. I show that the average baby boomers peaked in 2007, but my latest research from a new source, PayScale, shows that the college-educated full-time workers peak at age 57 before they fall off. That is this year. So we're going to see a second demographic hit. And the reason this group is so important, they're only 20-25% of the population, this elite group, but they earn about double, and they spend 50% of the money. So this is going to be another hit to the economy, another headwind for Donald Trump and his 4-5% growth, which I've been telling our subscribers, this is impossible to sustain. Our workforce growth, because of the aging of the baby boomers, is going to be flat for the next decade and grow at 0.2. Now, that's 0.2% at most in the decades to follow. Productivity peaked in the late 90s at 3% and is now at 0.5% because aging workers do not grow in productivity as much as younger ones. So this, again, aging of baby boomers, and my projections show it'll go to zero or slightly negative in the next decade. So we have pretty much 0-0.5% fundamental growth.
I've been looking back at history, pointing to Smoot Hawley. We had a huge front running where all the executives had to stock up before the tariffs hit. And then you see an economic boost. The stock market benefited at least for 6 to 12 months ahead. And then you have the hangover. I'd like to know, is that what you think we've just gone through? Or does the hangover start in the end of 2019? Or is this merely a negotiations ploy?
Yeah, I mean, we did get initial surge from money coming back and also people stockpiling. So that's going to be more temporary and it's going to go the other way. Most economists, even normal economists, think 2019 is not going to be as fast as growth. Also notice, in the 1929 top, two things happened. Started to restrict immigration like we're doing, and trade tariffs. The same two things at the top of a bubble. Both of those things are bad for the economy and help to pop the bubbles. Now, cryptos, to me, I've got a bubble model on everything, and everything's been following it beautifully except for gold, which is basing out higher than I would have thought, and cryptos at first, around 6,000 basing when they should have fallen to 1 to 2,000, but then they fell out of bed. So I think one of the things that could happen, I think it's still possible that cryptocurrencies are bottoming here or could bottom at about 25 to 2600, which would be similar to the 2013 to 15 bubble crash. People don't realize it looks small now. That was an equal size. So I see this last thing as like a third wave up, a fourth wave potential crash. And we could see, especially if the stock market does hold, I've been waiting to see if scenario two works.
There's been such a strong tie to the bubble in equities, the cryptos. You can't ignore that. However, most bubbles tend to return to at least their starting point.
I agree, and that's where I see it going down ultimately. I think it could go to 25,000 plus, because part of what happens, and this happened, the internet stocks, when they were young and in this hype stage, had nothing, but they were the next great thing, they went up and bubbled between late 98 and early 2000. They had a hype bubble like this and then crashed 95%. I think this one more wave up could complete this hype stage of the cryptos. Then they come down to reality like internet. Internet stocks crashed 95%. Looking at blockchain as Internet 2.0, that about 2035, 36, this will be a big much more mature industry. Surviving firms will end up converting their coins into token securities, and then they'll have to pay some regulations. But that's okay with me. It helps the industry. But I do think it, yes, it has long-term potential. Internet 2.0, it makes the internet better.
That's the blockchain side. But then there's the monetary side, the currency side, because let's remember, this is peer-to-peer money. It should have been here 20 years ago. They blocked it. You should be able to email or text people money. It should just be that easy and that secure.
My whole thing for the whole network information age and revolution, bottoms up everything, not top down. I would love to see currency be created, like you said, peer-to-peer by consumer transactions rather than central banks always trying to manipulate their economies. This is where we get in trouble. This bubble is twice as long and twice what it should have been if governments had just let it happen naturally. We wouldn't have, this thing is going to be the worst crash in history. Governments manipulated.
So true. Can you tell people about your services?
Go to harrydent.com and you get on our newsletter. Economy and Markets is our free newsletter. We have some paid newsletters, but the best thing, get on our Economy and Markets. You just put in your email and you're on our free newsletter. You can get to know it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris.
Pleasure to welcome Nick Barashev back to the show, CEO of Bullion Management Group and author of $10,000 Gold, Why Gold's Inevitable Rise is the Investor's Safe Haven. I have two hard copies here, published, I think, in 2013. It's hard to believe it's been that long. Welcome back, Nick Barashev.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back with us, as always. $10,000 Gold, many people will say that's a lofty target from current levels. It sounds like good news for our precious metals aficionados.
There's $300 trillion of financial assets made up of stocks and bonds globally. And there is, in terms of above-ground, investment-grade bullion, i.e. bullion, not, you know, stuff in the Hermitage Museum and, you know, artwork and so on. But of actual bullion is about 1.8 trillion.
Okay, so less than 0.5%.
That's right. So the math is that in the 70s, the conservative allocation was 5% to gold. So if you take 5% of 300 trillion, you get 15 trillion.
Yep, tenfold increase from current levels.
And if you divide, you know, 15 by 1.8, you get $10,000 an ounce. So sooner or later, you get that number, but I think the number will be much higher because when the market corrects, because we've got the first time that we've got a simultaneous triple bubble, when people panic from that correction, you'll get much, much higher than 5% allocation of gold.
Because not only is the typical portfolio incredibly light as far as gold allocation, you haven't even scratched the surface of the potential for investment. Yeah, people start to speculate on the prospects of runaway inflation, you know, circa the 1970s or currently in Venezuela, the Bolivar.
Well, currently, like, I mean, the canaries in the coal mine are more than just Venezuela. We've got Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, Turkey, Iran, South Africa. So these are like the canaries in the coal mine. This is what's happening there for all the same failed monetary policy. And eventually that'll come to North America for the very same reasons. Print endless money and you can't go endlessly into debt.
But we're convinced that our economic soothsayers, you know, in their ivory towers have got it all figured out this time. After all, you know, Nick Barashev, they have supercomputers, algorithms, and different economic models.
Where we've got a much bigger problem than 2008 is that the margin debt now is 50% higher than 2008. So when this market corrects and you get margin calls, the slide is going to be very fast.
Just to illustrate how quickly this all can unfold, even in Western civilizations, Venezuela is my favorite, not just Venezuela, but we haven't even discussed India, where, you know, the prime minister essentially overnight said, you know, I don't care for currency anymore in circulation. Let's just go digital. These things things can happen abruptly, and who knows? I mean, could we all wake up and the U.S. dollar has been devalued overnight, you know, by half, and everything in our bank account buys half as much as before?
Well, this is where, like, China, Russia, Iran, Turkey are buying gold, you know, in preparation for this, because the aim for them is to dethrone the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency eventually.
Or one might maybe look at it from another perspective and say they're simply preparing for the inevitable devaluation of the U.S.
Right.
currency.
That's right.
To listen to some of our officials and policymakers disparage China, if one finds a systemic illness, you know, within a currency market, I think inoculating your own currency with precious metals or gold seems like a prudent, you know, idea.
Exactly. The issue with China, like Russia publishes its gold purchases and has been considerable. In the case of China, they buy their gold through their sovereign wealth fund that doesn't report to anybody. And the gold in the central bank is static at 1,600 tons. So they move the gold from the sovereign wealth fund to the central bank when it suits them.
And the irony is we have over half of Americans, and I don't say this lightly or with any glib in my voice at all, I hope, but half of U.S. households are receiving some type of government assistance. Approximately 96 million able-bodied Americans have given up or have just stopped looking for work altogether. That's one out of three, approximately. And so one wonders if the monetary spigots or the handouts were to suddenly, let's just say, halt for whatever reason, maybe a temporary government shutdown, some other unforeseen event.
Right. The issue is that the mainstream media, all they do is they harp on the fact that the stock market's rising and the unemployment rate is low. But if you go to shadowstats.com, which gives you truer numbers, the actual unemployment rate is 22%.
Yes, you're exactly right. John Williams has been an excellent friend of the show over 13 years here. He does a truer measure of the GDP, actual price levels in the United States, and he points out that as long as these price levels are held artificially low, it seems to inflate the actual gross domestic product or our national output, which benefits, you know, whoever's in office to the disadvantage of 300 million Americans.
Yeah, the other thing that most people aren't aware of, but it's been implemented and done, is that under Basel III, the BIS rules call for gold being a zero-risk asset equal to treasuries or cash for a bank's balance sheet. That in the mainstream media ever?
Can you tell us what you feel the implications of this are?
Well, it's just that, you know, the banks can then, you know, now hold, you know, gold instead of treasuries and have the same effect on their balance sheet. That's the thing. Up till now, it was considered like a high-risk asset, and that's why the banks, they, you know, didn't hold it. Now they can hold it, just like they hold cash or treasuries.
Even the money purveyors have become so deluded with their own rhetoric that they themselves are actually consuming the proverbial Kool-Aid.
Yeah, but they've just done it, you know, quietly, and it doesn't appear in the mainstream media. But those rules have been implemented in all the Western countries.
Then when the music stops, which it always has done throughout, you know, financial history, let's just say the last 400 years, but we can go back to ancient Greece and Rome as well, and even earlier. But so when the music eventually stops, the safety valve has essentially been gutted here because our central bankers won't even have the ammunition necessary to stop the inevitable destruction. You've mentioned that peak gold production could also be an important supply component that might send price higher. Are you sticking with that outlook?
Yeah, it looks like gold production has peaked, and plus the thing is that if you discover gold, it'll take you 20 years to get the mine into production. So even if you were to have a huge find today, it wouldn't do you any good for 20 years in terms of supply.
The other compelling argument there regarding gold is, unlike silver, it tends to be identified deeply in the Earth's crust. And so even if we were to find another El Dorado-like potential mine, the effort to procure it is Herculean.
That's right. Like if the gold price rises because of sort of safe haven demand, mine supply isn't going to have any effect. There won't be any increase in mine supply.
The comments from the People's Bank of China regarding a convertible yuan into gold. This actually involves crude oil.
That's being established and implemented. So if you're an oil producer, say, like Iran, you can sell your oil to China in yuan, and then on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, convert the yuan to gold and sell the oil for gold.
So let's bring all the pieces of this intriguing puzzle together. If I understand you correctly, you're saying that the yuan essentially has at least a modicum of gold backing and, more importantly, convertibility with petroleum. They also now have a military that's starting to rival any other in the world. 500,000 of our high-paying manufacturing jobs have left our shores for theirs over the last decade. That's 5 million jobs. And they're the manufacturing superpower of the world.
China and Russia have publicly stated that their objective is to displace the U.S. dollar as the world's reserve currency into something else, maybe an SDR, maybe a petrol yuan, maybe whatever. But the Russia and China don't like the exorbitant privilege that the U.S. has by having the world's reserve currency. Everybody else has got to do something to make a living where the U.S. can just print the money. No other country can do that.
Okay, that, I guess, was one of the unintended benefits of having a reserve currency. But, of course, when the music stops, what would be the chief means of employment? Do we look to Great Britain, the former reserve currency, the pound there, as an example?
Well, it could be Great Britain, and can we look at what's happening in Venezuela, like, or Argentina. These were all, in the past, relatively, you know, good, strong economies.
Do you expect this endgame to unfold as it did in Venezuela? Seemingly overnight, in just about 12 months' time, a loaf of bread is at least 1 million bolivar.
Right.
John Williams, of course, Shadow Stats agrees with you, many of our others. But, you know, I know there will be the listener and the subscriber who says, you know, Chris, we've heard this for almost 20 years. Is this one of those moments where crying wolf is actually prudent?
The average performance of gold in all the currencies over the past 10 years is 10%. All the currencies, and what the return is, you get 10% over 10 years. So, number two, regardless of anything else, gold is the most negatively correlated asset to financial assets, meaning gold goes one way when stocks and bonds go the other way. In order to have the least risky portfolio, you need to have 10 to 20% in gold. So that way, when the stock and bonds correct, the gold goes up and vice versa. So you just hold 10 to 20%. You don't need a cataclysm for this to be justified. Put 10 to 20% in and forget about it. And you'll have a lower volatility, higher return portfolio. That's that. If gold goes to 10,000 an ounce, you'll be laughing. And if it doesn't, then you haven't lost anything. You've still improved your portfolio.
Exactly. And then I assume, though, that you are a bit wary of exotic precious metals instruments, such as ETFs.
Can't be in anything like that. It's got to be physical gold that you either own or is in custodial allocated storage, and there's a lot to check out there if you're going to store it. Depends on how much gold you're going to need to buy. If you're going to buy millions of dollars worth of gold, it's not practical to keep it at home.
So what are some of the obvious risks that investors should keep in mind?
Gold isn't any different than cars, boats, houses, or anything else, okay? So to own something, you have to have a transfer of title that specifically identifies the asset. So in the case of a car, it's make, model, serial number, etc. So I list those things, and I convey them to you. In the case of gold, I need to have the refiner, the serial number, the exact weight, and the exact purity, okay? And that specifically then is conveyed to me. It's not good enough to get a statement that says I own so many ounces. That means you own nothing. Unless you have the serial numbers and so on and so forth for the exact bars, you don't own any bullion.
You're thinking a few moves ahead on the chessboard, that when the music stops, people will only be, you know, safe at night if they've made sure the serial number of each coin or bar is registered with the storage facility.
Right. Now, coins don't have serial numbers, so you have to create a storage container with a serial number for coins, so you can do that. But the second thing that people aren't aware of also is the storage facility. So, like, you can own allocated gold, but if the storage facility, the vault, defaults on either its mortgage or its debt, and a trustee is appointed, the trustee is going to say, prove to me that you own the gold, okay? And if you can't prove to them that you own the gold, it goes into the bankruptcy pile. What you've got to do is you've got to do a lot of due diligence on the custodian, financial statements and so on, and you've got all kinds of people storing gold. Well, they can default on that. The powers of a trustee in bankruptcy are considerable, okay, and that's what happens if there's a default on either the mortgage or the lease and a trustee is appointed. The objective of the trustee is to get as much gold as possible into the bankruptcy pile.
Because they're looking to cover as much of their losses as possible.
Your listeners should just consider the fact that if they own gold, they've got a portfolio that's less volatile and less risky than without it. And gold goes to 10,000 an ounce. Well, it's not going to be a pleasant place on earth to be.
Folks who were just able to put aside a few gold coins in Caracas,
right,
just 12, 18 months ago. I mean, could you even fathom what could be purchased with those coins today? Doesn't it remind one of the stories we hear from friends and family in the Weimar, you know, Republic or after the World Wars in Central Europe?
That's right. That's where the kind of the insurance aspect of it comes in, so.
It's an almost impossible forecast or prediction to make because we don't know how governments will react. We don't know what measures they might try to use. They're certainly fighting the inevitable currency collapse in every way they can think of. Do you, like some people, think that by 2022 things could be unraveling quickly?
I think they could be unraveling quickly this fall. I mean, I can't see the market hanging in there when we've got bubbles of this proportion. Things are going to start unwinding there, and when it does, that's when the flood to gold will happen.
With rates so low for so long, and of course negative all over, especially in Asia right now and parts of Europe, with such artificially low rates, the U.S. having pretty much turned its back on QE, and now Europe and China talking about wrapping up QE, what would our officials and policymakers really have in place to battle the bubble implosions that you're talking about?
If the market crashes, they'll have to reverse their position and reinstitute QE.
And that, of course, leads to enormous sums of helicopter drops.
That's right.
If we do have that crack-up boom moment, then I guess you would first envision prices out of control and then global economy just shutting down for a while?
It could at some point in time, like people are going to not know what to trade in. We're already having problems when we're transferring, when investors are transferring money to, you know, buy bullion from us. That's already becoming a problem.
Tell people more about BMG Group and some of the services you provide, please.
Well, we have three mutual funds, like a gold, silver, platinum mutual fund, a gold only mutual fund, a silver-only mutual fund. And then we also sell a wide variety of bullion bars and coins that people can either take delivery or we can store it for them at Brinks in Toronto, Montreal, Calgary, Vancouver, Hong Kong, Dubai, Singapore, Geneva, and Panama. So you take your pick where you want it stored.
Then some of the advantages of BMG, please.
We're pure gold. We don't compromise the gold. Just facilitate it for investors and make it happen. Thanks again for having me on your show.
Well, you know, Nick Bereshef, we appreciate your thoughts and want to encourage everyone today to direct their web browsers to Bullion Management Group. We'll have links all over our websites at GoldSeek. And looking forward to hearing your next set of interesting insights on the financial markets as well as the precious metals, which we hope are finding a bottom here, maybe a capitulation.
Yeah, I think we're pretty close to that point.
So the book is available on Amazon and Kindle, so it gives people a good basic overview of money and gold and how everything works. So I encourage them. That would be a good starting point.
And would you say now that 3 or 4 years after its publishing that you feel the projection might have been overly conservative?
Well, yeah, because the debt has continued to go up.
Thank you, sir. Please return to the show.
Okay, bye now.
This is Robert Ian with GoldSeek.com Radio. A Reuters article this week disclosed that two high-ranking Venezuelan officials are traveling to London with plans to meet with the Bank of England over the repatriation of $550 million in gold held in the bank's vaults. Venezuela has 14 tons of gold it would like to repatriate back into its country's borders, against the backdrop of fears that its holdings of the yellow metal could get caught up in international sanctions currently imposed on the country, where hyperinflation is expected to reach 1,000,000% this year. Some in the British Parliament believe no meetings should take place on the matter because of sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Venezuela. According to the Reuters article, the Trump administration recently levied a new round of sanctions meant to disrupt Venezuela's gold exports. Where things get interesting is around the subject of repatriating gold the country already owns. Not that the Bank of England necessarily cares about Venezuela's ownership of their own gold, which has been entrusted to the bank's custodian services and probably rehypothecated a thousandfold. No, the bank is likely concerned with how this situation will play out with all the other developing countries who have also entrusted their gold to the Bank of England, and who would likely be concerned that they too might or could be targeted for having adversarial relationships themselves with Washington. This conundrum the Bank of England will have to face is more about what other countries do in response to their handling of this request by Venezuela, because the gold of those countries has likely been rehypothecated hundreds or possibly even thousands of times as well. The handling of one request for a relatively small amount of physical gold at the country level, if it is not managed correctly, could set off a cascade of requests for repatriation of gold from many countries. Hence, the proverbial snowflake that starts the avalanche. During the GATA Goes to London conference in 2011, which I attended, and it was arguably the best gold conference ever assembled on this planet, at that time, the late socialist leader of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, repatriated approximately 160 tons of gold from banks in the U.S. and Europe. According to this latest Reuters article, some of that gold remained in the Bank of England and is the subject of this current repatriation request. This is potentially a much bigger story than is being reported, for it is out of left field that the next leg of the financial crisis will make its sudden appearance. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.